This is Jeff Oswald at Concordia Seminary in St. Louis for another session of Lectionary at Lunch. In this session, we'll be talking about the first reading for the fifth Sunday of Easter, coming in year B, coming from Acts chapter 8, verses 26 through 40. This continues our reading of Acts in the first reading slot through the Sundays of Easter. The gospel for this Sunday would be John 15, the I am the true vine passage. The epistle, 1 John 4, he who is in you is greater than he who is in the world. Both of these other readings have themes that would certainly fit very nicely with Acts chapter 8, and you could pretty much pick any one of the three and use the other two to support and illustrate it. So I would encourage you, especially this week, to look over all three of the readings and see how they dovetail together. Now, our reading of Acts has been consistent in terms of happening every Sunday, but it's not been a very careful following of the storyline of Acts, jumping around quite a bit in chapters 3 and 4, and now suddenly we're in chapter 8. One work I've found that, for the most part, is quite helpful in tracing the larger trajectories of the Acts narrative is Tannehill's book on the narrative unity of Luke and Acts. And in Volume 2, he deals specifically with the book of Acts. Yeah, he interprets this passage in a slightly different way from what I had done previously, and yet I think there's a lot to say for his argument here. He says the story of the Ethiopian eunuch here in chapter 8 is certainly linked to what happens before, because the first half of chapter 8 also dealt with Philip and his work in Samaria. You remember the story of Simon Magus. However, he notes, in terms of the progress of the mission, it does not represent the next logical step, a stepping stone between the conversion of the Samaritans and of the Gentiles, which is the way some have looked at it, with the eunuch being attached at least to the temple in some way, even though he's not Jewish. But Tannehill says this is a leap to the extreme. Ethiopia was on the edge of the known world. This scene anticipates the power of the gospel to reach the end of the earth. Although it may seem out of order, if we anticipated a step-by-step progression of the mission from Jerusalem, the sequence of Samaria and the end of the earth fits Jesus' instructions in chapter 1, verse 8. I think that's certainly worth considering, and you can look at Tannehill's lengthier argument in support of that. And what we may very well be seeing happening here is Luke's suggestion that the gospel, of course, is not just following a single trajectory, but it's going out in all directions from Jerusalem at the center. And in this story, we see, in this chapter, we could say, we see that very literally, as Philip, who presumably is carrying out his ministry in Jerusalem, first goes to Samaria and then, in a very dramatic way, is told to go meet this eunuch on the road. The center of the passage contains what Barrett has called a gem of Greek conversation, and indeed this is a very fun passage to work through with the interchange between Philip and the eunuch. Let's turn to the text then and get started on it and work our way toward that gem. Well, we start then in chapter 8, verse 26. Angelos de Kyriou elalesin pros Philippon legon. An angel of the Lord said from Laleo, the aorist, to Philip, and Luke likes to use pros in the accusative with verbs of speaking, and then the participle saying. These opening words raise a few questions for us, the first being the identity of the speaker, and it is difficult to know exactly how to interpret angelos Kyriou here. On the one hand, in verse 29 down below, it will be the spirit, topnuma, who tells Peter to go and attach himself, join the company of this chariot. And later on in the passage, then, it will be the spirit of the Lord who removes Philip from the scene. It is possible that Luke means us to understand all three of these as a reference to God, and it's certainly clear that the main point of the whole passage is that the mission is still directed at every point by God himself, whether it's his Holy Spirit directly moving people or God acting through his ministering agents who are angels. This Greek would translate very closely the Hebrew construct chain Malach Yahweh that we're so familiar with from the Old Testament description of the angel of Yahweh. But it's difficult to assume that, at least in every case, that's what Luke intends, for in chapter 1 of his gospel, Luke has already identified the Angelos Kyriou as Gabriel. So in Luke's mind, at least, this doesn't seem to always have that exclusive reference to the angel of the Lord, who is in fact the Lord. But here you see angel and spirit working together, or even angel of the Lord being a reference to God's spirit at work among his people. Okay, we have already met Philip. He was one of the seven assistants appointed back in chapter 6. He carries out his work, though not at the table. At least that's not where we see him in the narratives Luke gives us. But like Stephen before him, he is actively engaged in spreading the word. Okay, so the angel says to him, Anastethi kai poru'u, kata mes embryon, epi tain hodon tain katabainusan apa Yerusalem es gadsan, haute estin eremas. So the angel says, and here you have two imperatives, get up and go. Interestingly, imitating language that sounds very much to us like Old Testament language, get up and go, kata mes embryon. This here means toward the south. Mes embryon is a combination of mesos and hemera, and means middle of the day, and can be used to describe the position of the sun. And yet here it means the south, because in the middle of the day the sun shines from the south. So go toward the south here. Epi tain hadon, along the road or on the road. And then kata bainu san, that goes down from Jerusalem. And of course, remember that when you leave Jerusalem, no matter what direction you go in, you go down from it. But in this case, Philip is actually traveling south. Ace Gadsan, toward Gaza. This was a city known to us from Old Testament times as well as one of the five chief cities of the Philistines. It's in southwest Palestine, and it was along the caravan route that would have taken you from Jerusalem toward Egypt. Okay, now, haute estin, this road, is eremas, deserted or isolated. Some commentators have said this isn't actually a desert, and yet eremas doesn't necessarily need to mean desert in a topographical sense. It can also mean isolated, desolate. And in fact, Bedag suggests we gloss it as lonely. Why Luke chooses to add that extra piece may simply be because when Philip meets this eunuch traveling, he is all alone. No one else passes them along this road. They don't see any villages or towns. So it seems to be just the eunuch traveling alone, that is with his party, but and then Philip who meets him on that road. Verse 27, Kai Anastas eperuthe, Philip does exactly as the angel commands him, and Luke, again, mirroring Old Testament phraseology, uses the same two verbs to show that Philip followed the instructions exactly. Kai Idu is also Old Testament sounding language, and behold, Aner, Aethiops, Eunuchos, Dunastes, Kandakes, Basilises, Aethiopon. Okay, so behold, Philip is not told what he will find when he follows the angel's instructions, just the direction that he is to head in. So Luke announces to all of us, we can share Philip's surprise at what he discovers, a man, an Ethiopian. Aner is regularly used with national or ethnic labels to indicate a person from a certain country or of a certain nationality or race. So here we have an Ethiopian man. We'll look at each one of these descriptors quickly in succession. Fitzmyer fills in a lot of the historical background for us in his Anchor Bible commentary. Ethiopia was an ancient name used for countries in Africa, south of Egypt, and the modern Sudan, areas we might think of as, Nubia, Abyssinia, other regions. Aethiops essentially means dark skin, literally people with a burnt face. So it was used to describe many of these central, at least south of Egypt, African lands. Ethiopia in the Masoretic text is called Cush. So we know it already from Genesis chapter 2. And in the Septuagint, either as Ethiopia or Cush, not being very careful to distinguish when one name is used over the other. Fitzmyer adds the comment, it's not surprising that an Ethiopian would be a Jew or a proselyte, because Ethiopic is a Semitic language related to Hebrew and Aramaic. There would, of course, be other obstacles, but most readers assume that Aethiops is indicating his race, ethnicity, not simply the country he lives in. Next, this Ethiopian man is a eunuchos. Bedag simply glosses it with the cognate eunuch. But it's interesting that if you look this up in Liddell Scott Jones, you find that it's a compound of eune and echo. It's a someone who has charge of the bedchamber, hautain, eunane, echon. So in and of itself, the word does not suggest castration, although that often accompanied the office of the person who was entrusted, certainly with guarding or supervising the royal bedchambers. Fitzmyer also comments on this, noting that neither the Greek term eunuchos or the Hebrew saris always connoted a castrated male. Sometimes it simply referred to the job of chamberlain, even if he were still able to produce children of his own. So we shouldn't make the focus of this passage the fact that the man is castrated, because the term eunuch doesn't always require that. It's still probably a safe assumption in this case, and we'll come back to some of the other questions that raises. He is also a dynastes, a person with power or authority, who is a court official, not necessarily a highest level official, but he serves in the court of Kandakes Basilises Aethiopon. Kandakes is usually simply transliterated as Candace, but this is not a personal name, but a title. It's the title that the Ethiopians used for their own queen. And since Luke knows his readers might not be aware of that, he adds the Greek term Basilisa for queen. She and is the queen of the Ethiopians. See the genitive plural there. Okay. And now the hos, relative pronoun, referring again to our man, not to the queen, ein epipases tes godses autes. He was over her entire treasury. That is, was her chief treasurer. It struck me reading this in Greek. You don't see it or hear it, I should say, in English, that God says. Actually, God saw. The word for treasury is the same as the word for the country, the city, God saw. But I couldn't see anyone comment on that in terms of being a play on words or anything. So he was her chief treasurer, hos eleluthe pros kuneson eis Jerusalem, who had come. This is the pluperfect of erchemai. I don't see that form very often. Who had come, and then pros kuneson from pros kuneo. This is actually a future participle. If you glance at it and think it's aorist, but wonder why the ending looks so funny, it's a epsilon contract verb, so you get the lengthening there and the addition of the sigma, but you have still the primary endings of own. This is not used commonly at all in the New Testament, although it's fairly common in classical Greek, and it expresses purpose. So who had come to be worshiping, to worship in Jerusalem. Now, the question arises, if this man is a Gentile and also a castrated male, how will he be able to worship, and what's the significance of him going to Jerusalem? It's interesting to compare Fitzmyer and Witherington on this passage. Fitzmyer brings out possible connections here with Isaiah 56, in which a day is promised when eunuchs will be welcome, and they will be members of the covenant. And Fitzmyer suggests perhaps Luke is at least hinting of the fulfillment of that prophecy by including this episode in his account. Witherington takes a more traditional view that the eunuch would not be allowed to approach to become, say, a proselyte or God-fearer because of his castration, and yet sees also a connection with Isaiah 56, but in the sense that this man is now welcomed fully into the new Israel defined by Christ. There is nothing that will prevent him from joining the Christian fellowship, even though the law had kept him distant, a distant observer at the temple with its ritual and ceremony. Again, I don't think that's meant to be the focus. Certainly the fact that he's coming from the end of the earth and that Philip meets him and is able to speak the gospel of Jesus Christ, that's the focus of the story. Okay, ein te hypostrephon kai kathemenos epi tu harmatas autu. So he was both returning and riding on his chariot. This is a carriage, probably a fairly simple vehicle. There are words for fancier covered chariots that richer people might ride in. And yet that, again, is certainly not the focus here. So he's been to Jerusalem. He's on his way home. He's sitting in his chariot. Kai anaginoskin ton prophetein eza'ion. He was reading the prophet Isaiah. The imperfect there, certainly showing that he was reading along as Philip intercepted his chariot. How did either Philip or Luke know he was reading Isaiah? Well, he was almost certainly reading out loud, and Philip is about to approach and then discovers what he's reading. Epende ta pneumato Philippo. So here we see the change of sort of identity of the divine driving force in this. Now the Spirit said to Philip, pros eltha, approach, kai kolethe ti. Kolaitheti is the aorist imperative passive from kolao, which normally means to glue something together. Go be glued to this chariot. But here it means attach in the sense of join the company there or associate yourself, not, of course, with the vehicle, but with the one in this vehicle pointing directly to the chariot. Okay, then 30, pros dramon. Again, Philip shows his willing obedience by running. This is from pros trecho. So he runs up to the chariot then, and as he ran up to it, ekousen autou anaginoskantes eisaion tain prophetein. As he's running up, that is, as he gets within earshot, Philip heard him reading Isaiah the prophet, Kai Apen, and he said to the eunuch now, Arage ginoskes ha anaginoskes. The first two words here are little words, which we often don't encounter and may be tempted to just sort of skip over and say we have the basic sense of it. But ara is an interrogative particle, as Bedeg tells us. In general, it's a marker of a tone of suspense or impatience in interrogation, looking for a correct answer, stressing the question. They simply gloss it as then. The ge is perhaps even more difficult. As an enclitic particle, it may seem to be too small to have much impact at all, but here it gives emphasis to the single idea. Maybe something like even indeed. The commentators struggle with how best to translate this. Barrett says we should probably emphasize the word do in the question. Do you understand what you're reading? Fitzmyer says, do you really understand? And notes that it's a leading question, asking the eunuch then to engage in the conversation. So do you really understand what you're reading? The two verbs here are also interesting play on words with ginoskes, to know something, and anaginoskes, to literally know it again if you take the verb apart to its compound. Do you know what you're reading? Do you recognize it? You cognize what you recognize, we might say, to put the pun into Latin. Okay, 31. Ha de apen, but he, now changing back to the eunuch, but he said, poskar an dinaimen, e an metis, ha de gese me. Pos, you know, is how, with the optative, not so much a straightforward how, but in the sense of how is it possible. The gar, again, here seems strange. How in the world could I understand? The eunuch seems to be saying. Parsons and Cooley here in their little guide to reading guide to Acts suggest that we might be intended or meant to assume a negative response. Of course not, with the gar following that. For how could I? And that would seem to make good sense of the construction then with the gar. The on with the dunaimen then gives us a potential optative, as Wallace calls it, a form that we don't see regularly in the New Testament. The optative as a mood itself is rare. But here it seems to have the force of, as Wallace suggests, if he could do something, he would do this. So he's it almost expresses a little frustration. This is the very thing he wants to do, but he's finding it difficult. But he responds to Philip's leading question with a leading answer. How could I, unless there were someone to guide me, to show me the way? Fitzmyer says this answer poses the classic problem about the interpretation of Scripture. One needs guidance if one is to understand it correctly. And this then opens the door to Philip to bring out the full meaning of the passage. Before we get to the passage itself, though, the eunuch continues, para kalesin taton philippon anabanta kathisai sunauto. So he calls to Philip, invites him, summons him to having come up, that is, climbing into the chariot to sit with him. That is, gives Philip the chance to be that guide to help him understand what he's reading. Okay, and there you you see the Philip is both the sort of the object of parakalesen and the subject of kathisai. Remember, infinitives normally take an accusative subject. Okay, then verse 32 now introduces the pericope. Hei de perioche, tes graphes. A perioche can be the content of a text you're looking at or a portion, a pericope, the way we use the word. And here, of course, it means both the content of this particular passage, hein anaginoskin, which he was reading, hein haute, was this. And then Luke gives us the passage, hos probaton epi svagen eichthe, as a lamb or a sheep, epi svagen, at slaughter, eichthe, like a lamb then was led off to slaughter, and hos amnas, like a sheep, or excuse me, switching them, sorry, like a sheep was led off to slaughter, and as a lamb, an amnas, and antion to kerantas, in antion before, opposite of, in that sense, before the shearer from kero, auton aphonos, so before the one shearing him is aphonos, soundless, silent or mute. So you have hos, kai hos, and then hutos, thus or so. Uk anoige ta stoma autu. So he did not open his mouth. Then so is, of course, reading from Isaiah 53. En te tape nose autu, he chrysis autu erthe. In his humiliation, his chrysis, his condemnation, judgment, Bedag glosses this as his punishment was removed or taken away from Iro here in the aorist passive. So you have hey chrysis as the subject of the passive verb in this time or through this experience of humiliation. His condemnation is removed. Tain genaan autu, his generation, his family history. Tis diegesitai, who will narrate, tell, relate, describe. Hoti iritai, apa tes ges he zoe autu. Parson and Cooley again say this. Hoti here gives the reason. Who will narrate it? Who could? Presumably no one, because Iritai, again from Iro, he was removed from the land of his life. Teskes he zoe autu. Those of you who are familiar with William Farmer's work might remember that for him, this second passage here was very significant in suggesting a reason we might have Gospels to begin with. He suggests that perhaps the evangelists, especially Matthew, saw this question that Isaiah had left unanswered and decided, of course, moved by the Spirit, that he would narrate this one's genaon, his family history, his generation. Okay, so that's the passage, and it's not very difficult for us to see how the eunuch might have found this confusing. But to make it clear exactly where he found the difficulty, he continues then in 34, apokrithes de ha eunuchos. So responding in a sense to the passage, but really continuing moving the conversation forward, the eunuch said to Philip, Deomaisu, I beg you, I implore you, please. And then almost need a colon there because he goes right into his question. Peritinos, concerning whom does the prophet say this? Periheautu, a periheterutinos, concerning himself or concerning some other person, someone different. This, of course, has been the ancient question with respect to this section of Isaiah's book. And you can, again, see in the commentaries the various solutions that were likely in circulation in the first century. Not too much has changed. People suggest the prophet meant Israel as a whole. Perhaps he was speaking of himself in the office of prophet as representative, or perhaps he had a messianic figure in mind. Anoixas de ha Philippos ta stoma autu. Luke uses this noble, sort of serious formula here to introduce Philip's speech, opening his mouth, reminiscent perhaps of the prophets, but also of Peter at the very beginning of Acts. So Philip, having opened his mouth, and arxamenos apates graphes tautes, beginning from this scripture, euangelisata auto ton Jesun. He evangelized Jesus to him. That is, he proclaimed Jesus to him. A couple of significant things about the wording here. The arxamenos does take us back to the beginning of Acts, indirectly perhaps to the beginning from Jerusalem idea, but certainly more specifically to Luke 24, verse 27, where our Lord arxamenos apa mouseos, beginning from Moses and from all the prophets, then explained how these things testified to him, opening their minds to understand the scriptures. So Philip, following exactly the same pattern, then begins from this passage in Isaiah and proclaims Jesus as the one about whom the prophet is speaking. Note also that it's beginning from this passage. So Philip, no doubt, wove together many different strands of the Scripture's proclamation of Jesus Christ, including, apparently, the idea of baptism. Otherwise, it's hard to explain the following question from the eunuch. So, hos de eparuanta, as they were then traveling along, and we're given the impression that, you know, we should see some passage of time here as Philip carefully explains all of this to the eunuch. Katatain hadon, along the way or the road. Eothan epi ti hidor. They come across or come upon some water with the ti here working adjectivally as a sort of an indefinite reference to water. Kai phasin ha eunuchos. And the eunuch, phasin is the third singular of phemi, again a a verb we don't often see in the New Testament, at least not as much as we do in classical Greek, although it's certainly not rare in the New Testament either. But the eunuch said, idu, hidor, taking us back to the idu on air. Behold a man here, behold water. Look, water. Ti kolue me baptisthenai. What prevents my being baptized? This is baptisthenai in the aorist passive infinitive. What would prevent the activity of baptism with me as its recipient? To sort of explain the construction here. Now, there is an insertion in the text, and we go right from 36 to 38 if we don't see that. Verse 37 provides the answer that a lot of people might expect to be here, that there may in fact be something preventing the eunuch from being baptized. So you have a reading that appears in the Western text and in some patristic quotations of the passage that runs something like this with minor variations. Philip said to him, if you believe with all your heart, it is possible. He said in reply, I believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. In analyzing the variant here, Metzger rightly notes that the phrase Jesus Christ is not a Lucan expression and believes that the formula has somehow crept in probably from the margins where it was used as a baptismal formula, with perhaps this being the text of the homily. Fitzmyer does point out, though, that this is an ancient variant. Irenaeus already knows it in the second century, and it needs to be looked at carefully, at least considered, even though I would still support the decision of the NA27 editors that we look at this as a variant and not the original text. 38, kai ekelusen stenai taharma. So he commanded, presumably the eunuch, but it could also have been Philip, the chariot to stand, to stop, to stand still. This is histemi in the aorist infinitive. Ekelusin usually has an accusative and infinitive to finish the idea there. So he commanded the chariot to stop, kai kat ebeson amphoteroi eis tahidor, and they got down, both of them, into the water. Ha ta philippos, here you see ta and kai working together, both Philip and the eunuch. And as Bedag notes, when ta is used with a noun with an article, it usually follows the article, as we see it here. Kai ebaptisen auton, and he baptized him, that is, Philip baptized the eunuch. Verse 39, hote de anebeson ek tu hydatos pneuma kyriou herpasen ton philippon. With an aorist verb here, on ebeson from anabino, which matches exactly the kat ebeson up above. They went down into the water, but when they came up from, with ek here, from the water, pneuma kiriu, the Spirit of the Lord, herpazen, from harpazo, to snatch, to grab someone, he grabbed Philip. Kai uk aiden auton uketi ha eunuchos. And the eunuch, now aiden, remembers the form of aidon, which is used as a second aorist of horao. The eunuch did not see him, and then you have the double negative for emphasis here, uketi, any longer. He did not see him no more. Eporueta gar tain hadon autu chiron. This is the verse that closes all our retreats. He went on his way rejoicing. Now, the gar here does seem strange to me, and Barrett noted that it seemed a little surprising. But he says it's probably, again, indicating something that Luke is assuming, that is an ellipsis that doesn't actually appear in the text, but something like, the eunuch saw no more of Philip, for he, unlike Philip, was not removed from the scene, but he simply continued his journey. Then verse 40, Philippos de hurethe eis adzoton. So Philip, on the other hand, that is, we've accounted for what happens to the eunuch. Philip was found, the passive of heurisko. So was found, or perhaps here simply intransitive, found himself in Azotus. This is the Old Testament Ashdod, another one of the principal Philippian cities, or Philistine cities, sorry, on the coast again of South Palestine. Kai diarchomenos euangelizata, you see the imperfect there, traveling through, he was evangelizing, tas poles passas, all of the cities. That is, he spread this same good news that is Jesus Christ to all the cities he encountered, heos to Elthane, up until the action of coming now with him as the subject, until he came, eis Caesareon, to Caesarea. The heos here could be temporal or spatial. Either way, it doesn't really affect the meaning. He continued this for some time until he reached Caesarea, or he went to throughout this whole region up to the point then when he came to Caesarea and remained there. In his commentary on Acts, F.F. Bruce gives us the concluding afterword. Philip, after appearing at Azotus, this is some 20 miles away of from Gaza. Of course, we don't know exactly where they were on the road. He heads north along the coastal road, preaching the gospel in all the cities through which he passed, until he reached Caesarea, where he seems to have settled down. At least, Bruce adds, that's where we find him when he makes his next appearance in the book of Acts, 20 years later, Acts chapter 21, verse 8. By that time, he had become a family man with four daughters, each one a prophetess, worthy children of such a father. Now, Barrett makes an even closer connection with the narrative, noting that when we get to chapter 21, verse 8, we are in a we passage. That is, Luke, as the narrator, is with the group, and so he says, we arrived at Caesarea. And though Barrett phrases this more cautiously than I think we need to, it certainly provides a link to this story and Luke's whole narrative. No doubt this would be a story that Philip would often have repeated, and Luke would have had a chance to interview Philip then, at least on that occasion, and probably on others as well. Okay, looking back then over the passage as a whole, I think there are some very wonderful possibilities for preaching. Not only does this take the narrative of salvation forward, as we noted at the beginning, moving away now from Jerusalem and actually already here, very early in the book, reaching the ends of the earth, at least through the Ethiopian who will take this gospel of Jesus Christ home with him. Another significant point, and probably a closer application to us, would be to go back and look at the eunuch's question. How can I understand unless someone guide me? This is certainly, I think, a powerful call to witness for all of us today, that we cannot simply think the job is done when we've placed the scriptures into the hands of people around the world, as important as that is. Because that's what had happened in the case of this eunuch, and yet he still couldn't understand. He needed someone to simply sit beside him and answer a few questions about the passage, about whom is the prophet speaking. what better time in the church year and in the life of the church than to raise this question with our congregations? Will we be that person who climbs up and sits down next to the stranger, perhaps foreigner, and helps walk him through the good news about Jesus Christ, so that this stranger too can go on his way rejoicing? We will stop here. I hope that's at least helped you see some of the details of the text and perhaps suggested an idea or two that you might follow up on in your own preaching. May God bless your study of His work. Thank you for joining me.